Good morning. Hello? So last time we talked, went into kind of our problem of framing, that we wanted to divide up bits or something else that was being sort of our unit of transmission. We use bits as our example. We learned that maybe some physical layers are going to transmit something a little bigger than bits. But in either case, we have these sort of fundamental symbols that are being transmitted, and we want to divide those up into different messages, which we typically will end up calling frames. And we sort of saw like two kinds of strategies for that. So one was with the start and end markers, and another was with sizes. We can actually combine those sorts of strategies. And we also wanted to deal with errors in transmission. And it turns out, we'll see later in the semester, we'll deal with errors transmission at sort of lots of layers of our network. But we'll typically want to do it at this framing layer because we want to catch errors close to when they happen for performance reasons. We learned from the end-to-end principle that we're not going to rely on that to actually implement our error detecting functionality, but it's going to be really good for performance, especially for things like Wi-Fi, where you know the nature of radio waves is that they're going to have a relatively high error rate. And we saw kind of the simplest strategy for that was these error detecting codes, which I call checksums. People who read the textbook carefully realize the textbook authors really don't like that term, but if you read like protocol specifications, they use it everywhere, regardless of whether it's actually a sum, which is the part the textbook authors didn't like, that there's error detecting codes, which are very much not sums. But people just like calling them checksums regardless. And we also mentioned sort of one thing we like sort of start and end markers for is that they can kind of recover from errors where we get desynced. So one thing which can happen is that the physical layers kind of, we have to match up the timing to have the same number of symbols per unit time. And if we don't do that, we're going to like miss a bit or add a bit somewhere. And we want to recover from that. We don't want to forever be desynchronized. So like a simple framing idea we might have is, let's say I'll send only 1,000 byte packets. So 8,000 bits. So every 8,000 bits is a message. And a big reason that doesn't work very well is that if we miss a bit somewhere, then we're messed up forever. We need some way of getting back in sync. And kind of the simplest strategy we saw was this idea of having some sort of start marker to indicate a message. A complication there is we need to think about what happens if our message contains that start marker. And one solution is we kind of escape it. There's some other things we could imagine doing that are more complicated, but simplest is we escape it. We also briefly talked about physical layers. We find something we can vary, like voltage, sort of amplitude of a radio signal, frequency of a signal. There's something we can vary, and the details of how that varying happens is probably an electrical engineering problem. But once we find something we can vary, we use that to send bits or other symbols. And a common strategy we'll end up having is that we want to synchronize the timing, and we can deliberately make sure there's transitions, there's some variation that we can use to get that synchronized timing kind of to happen without sort of an explicit signal about what here's when each bit starts. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time. Okay, questions about the quiz? I'll start back there.
So for question two.
Okay.
But if L got flipped, then it would create two separators back to back with no bit in between. And as the instruction said, a message is required to be at least one bit. Two separators back to back with no bit in between, I assume, would create no new message.
Okay.
I assume the same thing.
Okay, I will just accept the answer without that as an additional answer. I don't want to be picky about empty message versus a GOR message. And I'll update should be. Yeah.
I wanted to put in like fairly other mistakes where I had things in my notes, but I just put them wrong in the answer key. Should I put the request read now or after manual grading?
You could, if it's in your comments, after manual grading. If it's not, if the information isn't in your comments, you need to put a request because we don't know. But yeah, but to repeat what he said for recording reasons, you know, like basically there's the answer in the key is for question two is kind of assuming a blank message is not ignored, which is what we showed in lecture. I should just, and I think maybe, yeah, which is not what the question says. And I think that's just ambiguous. We'll just accept both answers. I should have been more explicit in the question about what happens with an empty message and the number of messages. And I don't want to be picky about that. Yeah?
I guess more general question. When it comes to like partial credit, should we be making regrade requests for these, or can we expect like a round of manual grading as well?
There will be a round of manual grading for, yeah, at some point. I'm not sure exactly when that will happen. I need to figure out what my TA schedules will end up being like. Yeah, but yes, you are correct. Sorry, I do not consider that in the people. I had someone check this question, but they didn't, we both didn't think about, oh, wait a moment, we said in the question, zero bit messages don't really count. We should have thought that. Okay. Other questions on the quiz? Okay. So I know some people started the framing assignment. Partly would like to remind you that that's out and due Friday. If you haven't started it. And kind of the idea of the assignment is that you're implementing a form of framing and you need to have some sort of error detecting code and you need to have some scheme that's going to handle that desynchronization problem. That's what the assignment is. And we give you some starting code, and I think the thing a lot of people have missed in the starting code is the starting code uses an incorrect framing technique where we given a message, the way we frame it is we take the message and we put a bunch of zeros after it. And there's a whole bunch of reasons that doesn't work. So one reason that doesn't work is that this message here could contain a bunch of zeros in it. And that's something we actually need to handle. Right? It's not, you would be unhappy if your network said, you can transmit any message that doesn't contain a null character. Good luck transmitting those, you know, PNG files. So you need to fix that at the least. And also, you need to deal with desynchronization and all that. And error detecting codes. No questions on framing assignment or other things we should come out quiz for that? Okay. Okay, so our main topic for the next few lectures is going to be doing reliable transmission, and some of this is stuff I covered for you in CSO 2 that we'll be extending, and the big thing we'll be fixing is that the scheme we had in CSO 2 is not very efficient, and we're going to want to make it more efficient. But kind of our fundamental idea is that, you know, we want to make sure a message gets from A to B. And how we're going to do that is we're going to send an acknowledgement from B to A saying, yes, it actually got there. And I'll use the short term ACK for acknowledgement to represent this message. That's also the term you're going to see used in pretty much any real protocol that does this. And if the message doesn't get there, we're going to have you know, some amount of waiting, we'll call a timeout. And a question we're going to have to answer is, how do we set that timeout to the right amount of time? And after that timeout, we're going to try again. So questions on kind of our basics of acknowledgments here. So we're going to, every time we have a message, we're going to have an acknowledgment sent back. If we don't see that acknowledgment after a certain amount of time, the amount of time we call the timeout, we're going to send it again. And so kind of our protocol here is on the sender, until we receive an ACK, we send a frame of data, wait some time for an ACK. Just repeat that until we actually get an ACK back. On the receiver, we wait for a frame of data and send an ACK back. And something I didn't show explicitly here is that this same scenario can happen where we lose the acknowledgement instead of where we lose the original message. And that's fine. We're just going to send an extra copy because it's going to take us extra time to figure out that the message was lost. The protocol doesn't change. What does change is machine B needs to realize that we got two separate messages here that are just duplicates. We only care about one of them. Yes?
How does the protocol handle someone being malicious? Or let's say data gets corrupted somehow, and the second copy is different than the first.
How does the protocol handle if the second copy is different than the first? Generally, we don't. So as far as the message being corrupted, we're going to have checksums. That's how we're going to solve that problem. And otherwise, we don't. We generally are not going to handle that question, meaning that if you do that, who knows what a program on machine B is going to read, right? Look, it could read either version or some mix of them, and that would be what you'd expect to happen. Yes?
Are you talking about machine A sends a message, it gets lost, they send it again, and machine B doesn't check for parity between the two copies of the message? Is that...
So the question is, what was he asking about? The scenario he was asking about is, let's say that when we repeat this message, we send... change the message a little bit. What happens on machine B? I'm running, I run read here. What am I going to get out of that? And the answer is the protocols don't expect the message to change, so who knows? Yeah.
So let's say that machine B is kind of broken and it doesn't send acknowledgement back. And does machine A have any way of handling the fact that, hey, I'm keeping on sending these messages to message B, I'm getting no acknowledgement, what will it do about this?
So the question is, you looked at this protocol, and it doesn't have a stopping condition before machine A if ACKs are never received. And you said one case is where machine B could be broken and just not send ACKs back. There's actually a more common case, which is like, I'm on the Wi-Fi, and then I close my laptop. And it goes to sleep. You're never getting your acknowledgement back. So there's some caveat here, and this is going to occur with most of our protocols, and that's that this is really until an ACK is received or we give up. And when we give up, probably we're going to indicate an error to someone. And I guess I should have this on the other part, right? This is also kind of true everywhere. There's usually always kind of an implied until we give up. We're not going to be infinitely patient in all these protocols and when we actually implement them. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this handles sending one message, but actually we're going to need to split up our message. And why do we Want to split it up? Well, because typically our data link layer is not going to support an infinitely large frame size, is one reason. Another reason is maybe we don't produce all the data to send all at once. If we're sending a gigabyte file, we probably don't read the whole gigabyte file into memory, then send it. We probably read it in pieces and send each piece. But even if we're, you know, sending something more modestly sized, it turns out that the data link layer won't support that big of a size. So as kind of a practical matter, so the typical internet supports about 1,500 byte frames. So if you want to send something in that's bigger than 1,500 bytes, you have to split it in multiple frames for most of the internet. This is, I'd say, typical. This is not actually universally true. It can be larger, it can be smaller, but that's about the size that is typically supported, just because that's the framing protocols that are used to carry traffic across the world have typically chosen that kind of size. So we're going to need to split data into multiple pieces. In my case, I'm splitting them into pieces that are way smaller than 1,500 bytes, but that's because I want examples on slides and not just... But 1,500 bytes is not big. You know, you can transmit things that are pretty, you know, like a web page. You can't transmit in one frame, maybe not even like 10 frames. Pretty easy. Yeah?
Is that number revised frequently, or has that been for a while?
Question, is that number revised frequently, or has that been for a while? So networking technology has started supporting larger frame sizes, because the 1,500 byte size was kind of defined when we were like in the megabit speed range. However, it's not actually that common that it's supported. And what will happen in practice is that you can kind of probe what size the network supports. We may talk about this much later in the semester when we talk about routing, because, you know, what makes sort of this size complicated is what happens if I go from, from here to, across the country, and I'm going through like 10 different networks, and they all have different frame sizes. How does that work? That's a question we're going to have to answer. Okay. Other questions? So we have this size limit. So we're going to split up our message into pieces. And kind of the straightforward thing is we send the first piece, then the second piece. But this doesn't work out very well, because we can have kind of duplication of messages. And previously, what I said would happen is machine B would realize, oh, it's a duplicate. Here, if we do the straightforward thing, we get, say, the message is the meeting is at 12 p.m. And well, that's obviously ridiculous, but in general, we can't actually know that that's ridiculous. We can have actual duplication in the middle of our message. We want to have kind of a more reliable way of figuring out what's going on. All right, but this is what we'd reconstruct if we just follow the sort of blind reconstruction. We could imagine trying to have a heuristic saying, oh, there's a duplication here, let's remove that. But then that means we can't send messages that have legitimate duplication, which is going to happen sometimes. And this is not the only kind of scenario where we can have problems. So let's go through what we receive for each of these other cases. So let's say in our example, we sent the, lost the ACK, we sent the, got the ACK, and sent the is part. Right, that was the original example. Let's go through these other scenarios. So let's start with scenario one. Can someone tell me what would we receive in that case, where we'll say the first message instead of the first acknowledgement is lost? Just is at 12 p.m. is what we receive? Okay.
Or assuming that it doesn't try and reset. Oh, actually, would we send the app?
So you're saying, assuming you're trying to, but you realized, oh, wait a moment, you remember what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
So we're assuming we're implementing this protocol still.
It would still eventually get connected.
Yeah. So assuming what we do, which is what we're going to assume for now, is that we send the, and then we send the and get the app. Then we're going to send is, it's going to be the same as the original scenario. So we're going to have the meeting is at 12 p.m. It's going to work out the same. An important part of this is that we're implementing that protocol. Another way we could have figured out that it has to be the same is that if we think about what machine A sees here, machine A can't tell the difference, actually, between the scenario where our message is lost in transit and the acknowledgement is lost in transit. As far as what machine A sees on its wire going to the network, it's exactly the same. Yeah?
But then why would machine B receive the meeting twice?
Oh, sorry. Machine B wouldn't receive the meeting twice. Yes. Okay. Correct. So in this case, it would be actually correct. Sorry, I messed that up. So is at 12 p.m. We'd magically get the right answer in that case. Sorry, because machine B, you know, if we have this loss here, we're missing that first duplication, and hey, it looks better. So how about item two? Let's say our first message is delayed for a long time by the network. Yeah.
I think in that case, you might just receive, that would be weird. I think, because what would happen is, let's say that the delay is longer than the time the sender is waiting for the act,
mm-hmm.
then it would send, the meeting, the other one would not get it right away, and then it would send the meeting again, it would get an act, but then it would get the other meeting and send another act, and so I think that it would... Like, I don't know what the recipient would think when they saw it. They would see an extra act, right?
The recipient would see an extra act, or?
Well, because they would assume that the first message was lost because they would be waiting too long for the act. But then the act would come later.
So observing one thing, which is not actually the main question I'm asking, is that the sender would get an extra act.
Yeah.
Extra act, and that seems problematic. Yeah. Yeah.
You could have a scenario, you have a lot of funky scenarios. Like you send the message, the meeting is floating in the ether for a little while. You send the meeting and the new is at 12 p.m. All of a sudden at the end you have a new the meeting.
Okay, so one possibility is that the meeting is at 12 p.m. and we have a delayed the meeting. Yeah.
I think you could also have
Yeah, we could all, and you're saying we could also have the meeting is at 12 p.m.
If you lose packets in the middle, you can even have something where you don't get it is at 12 p.m. because you're at the meeting. The one that's floating out there could be perceived as the act to the is at 12 p.m. if you lose a packet from the is at 12 p.m.
Yeah, so it's going to turn out we have an issue where we can, which we'll talk about in a bit, where we can... Since we're getting this extra act, we can misassign that act to the wrong thing if we aren't careful. And that we'll need to fix. So something I should talk about is, if you look at what our textbook does, our textbook talks about reliability for direct links. And if we actually have a direct link from A to B, things shouldn't get reordered, right? We send them, they should be sent in order to receive. So how can we actually get this delaying scenario? Why do I care about it? And it's possible in many real scenarios on the real internet because we have multiple hops that we don't just have one link from A to B, we have A to B communicating via switches and routers. So one thing which can happen is we can have multiple hops multiple paths from A to B, one of which is slower or faster than the other. And for some reason, the network chose one versus the other at some point. Another way it can happen is that we can be, if we're kind of doing this recursively, which ends up happening with like Wi-Fi, that the sort of process of doing acknowledgments and resending can cause things to end up in different order, because something resent in the middle will be later than something that wasn't resent in the middle. And there's also some other reasons this can happen having to do with how the switches manage the buffer. So we kind of talked about the buffers as, you know, it seems like, oh, they're just a queue that you keep in order. Some switches and routers might not actually keep them strictly in order in all cases, in which case they might get reordered a little bit there. How about scenario three?
You would get the meeting is at 12 p.m. Is at 12 p.m. to potentially resend the second packet.
Okay. Yeah. So this would be we'd resend the second part instead of first part. So we'd end up duplicating the second part instead of the first part. So questions on our possibilities for these sort of three scenarios? Yeah?
Could you explain the second problem one more time?
Can I explain the second problem? The second problem is that basically on this diagram, right, let's say instead of having this, let's say instead of the message being lost or anything like that, we don't have this here, but instead it gets delayed because the network is slow, because maybe there's that second path that's relatively slow. Or it might get delayed to there, or it might get delayed to there, and in either case, we'll kind of have an extra copy of the meeting received by machine B at some point. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So of course, any case where we can't recover the correct message is a problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to mark the parts of the message with some number. We're going to say this is part 0, part 1. And now, when machine B gets two copies of part 0, it knows they're actually duplicates. It knows the message doesn't actually duplicate the phrase. And it can tell if it did, because it would be part 0 the meeting, part 1 the meeting, if that's what we really intended to send. So we now kind of have this sort of out of band information. It's not part of the message information telling us which part is which. We don't have to guess which is which. And another thing we'll need to fix is that we need to make sure that we know what the acknowledgments are for, because things end up being reset. So one example here is there's nothing actually lost here, but we set our timeout wrong. We set our timeout very, very aggressively, and we ended up sending an extra copy of part 0. And that shouldn't be a problem, but in this case it was, because we received 2x, and we kind of blindly assumed, oh, this ACK is for this message, and this ACK is for this message, and that's not what machine B's perspective is. So in order for us to not have this kind of mixed idea about what the acknowledgments are for, we're going to label the acknowledgments with what part they're acknowledging. Yeah?
Let's say part A thinks part 0 and 1 is acknowledged, instead of part 2 is acknowledged.
Should say part A
at the bottom of the last slide.
Should this be ACK part 0 plus 1 is your question?
No, if you go back a slide, in the footer of the slide,
should it be this be 0 and 1? Yes. question, you're assuming that there's more than one parts, would be 0, 1, 2, 3. That is one option. We will actually probably start with 0, 1, 0, 1, but we'll talk about that very explicitly later. Other questions? Yeah. And so in this case, when we receive our extra app, we know what message it's actually for. And you know, we can still figure out that we need to resend part one in this case where that got lost. So these part numbers, we're going to have a term for them called a sequence number. In almost all of my slides and kind of the examples in the textbook, our sequence number is going to be the message or segment or frame. We'll have lots of different names for these individual things we send over the network. But it's going to be the number of that message or frame or segment. If you actually look at what TCP does, like if you open up Wireshark, you'll see sequence numbers and you might be confused. Wait a moment, why is it going from like, you know, 1 million to 1 million 1,000? What's happening? And the reason is that the TCP sequence numbers are byte numbers, not message numbers. But we're going to simplify things by working with message numbers on the slides and in an upcoming assignment. Yeah.
Is there a reason for doing byte numbers so you can verify that, like, if you get off by something, you would know that you had missing data between?
So the question is, do we need to use byte numbers in TCP in order to verify we received all the data? Not really, because we have checksums. I think the reason TCP uses byte numbers is that it's possible we'll change the size of the frames we send between when we send them the first time and when we resend them later. And so using byte numbers makes that possible to do. If we didn't use byte numbers, that wouldn't be possible. So like a simple example might be, you know, if I'm typing something and it gets lost the first time, you might send like 3 bytes, but then I've typed an extra 4 characters. When we send it, we prefer to just send all 7 characters rather than sending 3 characters and then 4 characters. And TCP scheme allows you to do that kind of thing. Whereas if we just use message numbers, once we've sent something as 3 characters, we have to keep sending it as only 3 bytes at a time. Okay. Other questions? So a question we might have is like, how big can sequence numbers get? And this is a real problem. And with our first version of our scheme, you know, we're going to have a nice, elegant answer to this, especially because I'm going to totally ignore that messages being delayed problem for now. We'll revisit that later. But if we assume we have like a direct link, there's this nice, elegant answer that's going to make it very easy. And the reason we want to limit the size of the sequence numbers that, well, we can send a lot of data. If we send like a gigabyte of data, how big does our sequence number need to be? If we're sending a gigabyte of data per hour for, you know, a week, how big does it need to be? It gets pretty big. And with the scheme I've shown you so far, we can actually get away with 1 bit, assuming we don't have any delays. So assuming we don't have these long delays that like make messages go out of order, assuming the messages stay in the order we send them, we can just alternate between 0 and 1. And that's going to be good enough. So we can kind of think of our sequence number is just to make sure that, you know, that the other machine has advanced to the same message or not. We only need 1 bit to tell it, either on the even messages or the odd messages. So questions about this 1 bit sequence number? Okay. And this works because we're going to have a policy here where we never send the next thing until after we send the previous thing. Now, as we'll see later, well, we don't actually want to do that. We want to send more than one thing at a time. But if we're not doing that, we only need one bit, assuming the network doesn't really delay things to mess us up. And our textbook calls this scheme stop and wait. Because basically, we send something, we wait for the acknowledgement, we send, you know, and stop while we do that, then we send the next thing, wait for the acknowledgement, and so on. And this is the simplest way we can implement reliability. And we want to understand this method before we move on to sort of more advanced methods that are going to be a lot more efficient. So they're going to be built on this method, but sort of, you know, say, how can we avoid stopping and still have it work? And so let's do a little exercise here. Make sure we understand what's going on. Oh, I forgot to change these slides. It's when I say got, assuming that's ack. And in all these cases, I changed that on some of these slides, but not all of them. So we're implementing machine B. What should machine B do? No. So who thinks it should do A? Thinks it should do B? C? Okay, something else? Okay, so we have most people saying A, some people saying C. So I think the justification people have for C is, well, we already sent ACK of 0. Why do we want to send anything again? And we can't send ACK of 1 because we definitely didn't get 1. We definitely shouldn't send ACK of 1. Everyone agrees about that. But there's a problem with sending nothing, which is that this indicates that maybe machine A lost this acknowledgement message. So we want to eventually send ACK 0 again. And if we're following the steps I wrote down earlier, when were we going to do that? We're going to do that immediately. Now, you might imagine maybe we could find some way of like not doing it immediately and like delay it. I don't think that's totally unreasonable. But I think our intuition is that if we're receiving a second copy of the of part 0, that probably means that something happened that means that machine A doesn't know we received the first one and we need to tell it. Because seeing the second copy tells us there's a good chance our acknowledgement was lost. Not guaranteed, but there's a good chance. So I think the better choice is to send it right away, not to like wait or anything like that. So questions? Answer there. Okay, so let's do, and the same substitution here. I should have written, I forgot to replace some of these lines. Okay, so hopefully this is, I'm hoping this is straightforward. Anyone want more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? Okay, so we have all agreement that we should acknowledge the new thing we received. And note that it doesn't matter that the second part happens to be the same. It's just that this message is XX. That's all. It's fine. Okay, so how about this scenario? And we'll replace all of these with X. Thank you. And remember, we're assuming by choosing this 0-1 sequence number method that we don't have those long delays. If we did that, we'd have to do something else that's going to be relevant here. You can check with your neighbor if you want to verify this. Who thinks we should do A? Okay, B, C. Okay, so we have consensus on A. Good. Let's try this one. So let's say the message we're trying to send is X, Y, Z, and we're sending that in three parts. We're doing our one-bit sequence number idea again. And again, we're hoping there's no delays that reorder things, because otherwise, one-bit sequence numbers don't work.
Hey, what's the third option? I can't remember the bottom two.
They're like some more time? Sure.
Has it been, like, since A is at 1y, has it been the amount of time that A will wait before sending another message?
Didn't specify, so we'll look at both answers, both ideas for that. Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, so we have a split between B and D. And so probably what happened here, we don't know for sure, is probably we kind of misjudged, which the matching between our acknowledgments and our messages. So we just got an extra acknowledgment because, it turns out that first one we resent wasn't lost. So if we assume that we haven't gotten an acknowledgement for one yet, what we want to do is we want to resend part one, that one. So I think B is a reasonable answer, but there's kind of a caveat there that we don't want to just keep resend it right away just because we got an acknowledgement. So there's this part we're missing, which makes D a good answer, which is wait until timeout for sending one, then for sending, I guess, one Y, then send that message. Right. We don't want to do it just because we got an acknowledgement. We want to wait the appropriate amount of time for machine B to send us back the acknowledgement of one normally. If we send it right away, you know, that's not going to be broken, but it's going to be inefficient. We're using spending stuff on the network that we don't need to. It's going to, you know, makes other people have less stuff they can do on the network. Questions? Through there. We'll do this variation here. Like more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, we have good consensus on C. Yeah, this is the normal operation. We want to move to the next part, and if we're using 0, 1 sequence numbers, the next sequence number is 0, not 2. If we're using bigger sequence numbers, it's going to be 2. Yes?
Could there be a case where that got 0 is, I know that we're assuming like no crazy delays right now, but could there be a case where that got 0? Act zero is received after the act one, and so for the second X that we sent.
Question, could there be a case where the act zero is received after the act one? That is precisely the delays we're hoping don't happen.
Okay.
So if we want to handle those sorts of delays, the answer is going to be don't use a one-bit sequence number.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so there's kind of two issues with stop and wait we're going to want to deal with. So one is that it doesn't use the full capacity of the network, right? We aren't even close. And another is we want to figure out how to set the timeouts. We kind of missed that issue. How do we actually set our timeouts? And to talk about both of these things, I'm going to like have an interlude here to talk about sort of general metrics for networks in general. So we're going to care about these network metrics for our reliable transmission, but they're also going to come up on a bunch of other topics. So we're going to have throughput and bandwidth. And this is kind of how much capacity is there. And we'll often distinguish the capacity we actually achieve, which I'll usually but not always call the throughput, with the available capacity, which I'll usually but not always call bandwidth. We also need to know about how long it takes messages to get there. So we'll call latency is the sort of one direction or usually one direction time. And we'll often talk about the round trip time, which is the time to get a message from machine A to machine B, and then back from machine B to machine A. And round trip time is going to be like how we want to set our timeout. So if we measure our round trip time, that gives us a good idea of what is a good timeout, because that's the expected time for us to get an ACK. So we can look at the round trip time, figure out sort of what the high end of that is, set our timeout there. Yeah?
Round trip time is not just the time that the message spends on the wire, right? The time that
question, the round trip time is not just the time on the wire, it's the time, includes the time to process and send a response? Yes. So it's kind of the empirical time from we send something to we get something like an acknowledgement back for it. So it's all in for all the processing that happens on the network. And we'll also learn about jitter, which is kind of variation in latency is something we also might care about. So let's look at bandwidth is kind of our simplest. It's the rate we can send per unit time. Something I'll note in network is that typically network bandwidths are in, you know, and typically you'll see them expressed in something like gigabits per second. And note something here is that this is bit usually or I guess often bits, not bytes. And not bytes. So you might expect it to be bytes. It's often measured in bits. So pay attention to that. A gigabit network cannot transmit a gigabyte per second. It is about an eighth slower than that. And usually, this is going to be an actually like 10 to some power when we're using giga, mega, and so on. Not 2 to a power. So in, when we're measuring like file sizes, we often like will say, or like size of RAM, for example. If we say a machine has 16 gig of RAM, we probably mean has 2 to some power of RAM, not actually 16 billion, but a little extra because of that power of two. If you're looking at networking stuff, they usually aren't doing that power of two thing. They usually really mean base 10 units. And you, generally when we talk about throughput, we're gonna talk about the actual achieved rate. And that's usually gonna be lower than sort of the bandwidth of the link because we have to add some extra stuff. So we learn in framing, oh, we're adding these like checksums and the start-stop and maybe doing some escaping. That's gonna cut into the throughput we can actually get on that link even though the bandwidth is higher. So our throughput, our effective bandwidth is lower than what the link physically does. So questions about throughput bandwidth? Yeah.
Is bandwidth usually describing like capacity of the wire or the capacity of the protocol, right? Because if you're using like, let's say you have headers and you have checksums, you're going to be sending less data than you could if you were just sending the data itself.
So the question is bandwidth usually describing the capacity of physical capacity or like what the protocol can do. So you'll see both. If people are distinguishing bandwidth and throughput, they are distinguishing sort of actual like with all the overheads versus not, but often they'll just casually say, you know, then we have a bandwidth of X and A. I mean, that's the bandwidth, you know, that's the throughput after accounting for some of the overheads. Does that answer your question? If we really care about being precise, we're going to have to say what overheads are we accounting for? Or we'll say something like the data rate on the wire is this, you know. So that's bandwidth. So let's talk about latency. And let's talk about like where latency comes from. So let's say I forgot to do the per second part here. But let's say I have a 50 megabit per second link that's 500 meters long. And that means that we can send one bit every, you know, 1/50 million seconds, so about 0.02 microseconds, sorry, assuming I did my math correctly. So it takes 20 microseconds to send a 1,000-bit message. And we'll call this the transmission delay. So our latency we can kind of divide up into components. One of them is going to be this transmission delay. And it also takes some time for a message to go down the cable because it's 500 meters long. It has, empirically, it has about a speed of 2.3 times 10 to the 8, which I looked up. We don't expect you to memorize that sort of thing. That's kind of the empirical speed down a copper wire of a signal. It's not quite the same as the speed of light, but it's close. And we'll call that the propagation delay. So we have some transmission delay because we can't just send 100,000 bits all at once. You have to kind of separate them. And we have the propagation delay because it takes some time for them to get down this cable. And that gives us a latency of, in this case, 22.2 microseconds for the message to get from S to D, source to destination. Some questions? How I computed that? Yeah.
In the reading, it said like the propagation delay was like related to the speed of light. Can you explain that?
Question: in the reading, it said the propagation delay is related to the speed of light. So yeah. So in this case, I'm saying I have copper.
Yeah.
So, and the way I'm sending messages down copper is probably I'm varying the voltage on that copper, and we're relying on sort of physically, when we put a voltage on one part of a piece of metal, right, we can see that same voltage on the other part, and that's not instantaneous. It better not be, because nothing in physics is actually instantaneous. And it turns out if you measure it, it's almost the speed of light that that happens at. It's not quite the speed of light, so this number I have here is slightly slower than the speed of light, but it's close to the speed of light is how fast that voltage change can propagate, you know, through, you know, all the electrons and other stuff going on in the atoms of the actual copper metal in that cable. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
And our exercise in the next part will be about fiber, which is much more directly related to the speed of light, but also not going to be quite the speed of light, and we'll talk about that in a second. Other questions? Okay, so that's our latency here. So let's do another example here. Let's do exercise, so communication. So let's say I have a gigabit thing that's 10 kilometers of fiber. And let's just say the speed of a signal through fiber is about 2 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. You might say, why is it slower than our copper? So we're sending light, right? Isn't light fast? Very fast, and it is, but you know, it's going through fiber. What's kind of physically happening is the signal doesn't actually go, is doing something with the edges of our fiber. It's not like going through a vacuum, right? The fiber isn't a vacuum. It has things it has to bounce off of and go through. It's not the same speed as like shining a laser through space. So, great. And I guess I don't have this worked out. So what would our math be for doing computing this? I guess I will. What's the first step I should do here?
How long does it take to send 1 bit?
So time to send 1 bit, okay. Bit. Yeah, so that's probably a good first component here. And that's going to be 1 over 1 second divided by 1 billion bits, right? That gives us our time. And that's going to be, I believe, 1 nanosecond, send a bit. So we have our transmission delay is going to be equal to 20,000 nanoseconds. And then we have to add our propagation delay, which is going to be the time it actually takes to send sort of that first bit that needs to get from S to D. Right, so we have to get that first bit there, and then we have to wait for all the other bits to be sent, and they'll each take the same amount of time to get there. So that's going to be 10 kilometers divided by, 2.0 times 10 to the 8 meters a second, and you do the units computation to make that actually work out. And you'll get the propagation delay, and you just add those together. That's our expected, that's the latency of this connection. Questions on how I figured that out? So this is our latency when we have just one direct link, but often we don't. So we'll have some processing time. So in this example, I'm saying that I have a switch here, and in my switch, I have five other things in the queue when the packet arrives. And we're going to have to wait for us to get to the the top of the queue to actually have our packet sent. So we're going to have an additional component to our latency, which is going to be what we'll call queuing delay. So in this case, it's kind of the minimum queuing delay is we have to wait for all five of those packets to be transmitted before our packet can be transmitted. We have to wait behind them in line. So we call that extra time queuing delay. And in this example, that queuing delay is substantially longer than the actual latency of our two wires. And that's actually pretty typical. So our queuing delay is longer. And so I'm saying here, like we have our transmission delay for one packet. Plus, five times. And something I'm not showing here is we might have sort of plus other processing time. So I'm assuming here that the switch kind of instantaneously gets our packet into the queue, instantaneously figures out how it's going to send it and all that stuff. That's probably not instantaneous. And generally, we'll consider all that sort of processing time part of the queuing delay. Hopefully it's minor compared to the actual waiting for the other packets, but maybe it won't be. Okay, so questions? How this works with sort of multiple hops. Yeah?
Are we not including the transmission delay from S to switch? Because I see propagation delay on the
Oh, sorry, this is, this is mislabeled. This is propagation delay plus the transmission delay. This is the exact calculation we saw in our example here.
Okay.
That's how we got that, sorry. This line is just mislabeled. So our total latency includes a bunch of, includes a bunch of transmission delay and propagation delay and the queuing delay. And kind of, it turns out, the queuing delay is most of our delay, followed by the propagation delay, which is 40 microseconds of it, followed by our transmission delay, which is 4.4 microseconds in this example. So questions?
So in the queuing delay, we accounted for five packets, right?
Yeah.
But we're not sending 5,000, in total that's 5,000 bits, right?
Yeah.
And we're only using the 1,000 bit transmission across the cables. Shouldn't we be using the 5,000 in total bits.
So question is, we're counting for five packets. Like, why are they not accounted for, in this part, is your question.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of my assumption is that the queuing is coming from something else.
Okay.
Right, there's something else happening in the network which is causing our queue to be filled up that's competing with us. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah, so indeed, if S and D are the only participants on this network, we wouldn't have anything in the queue unless S put it there. And if we did, like presumably it gets out of the queue first. The reason we have a queue is that there's other things going on in the network that are sharing these links. And presumably that's happening though, because why would we have a switch if S and D are the only machines on our network? We wouldn't, so it wouldn't make sense to do that. Yeah.
Well, why are we not accounting for the transmission delay for the packet we're talking about? Right, because if we're waiting for all five of the packets to go, then don't we also have to wait an extra 20 for our packet?
So why are we not accounting for the transmission delay for our packets?
Yeah, like do you understand what I'm saying? Like it gets to the switch, then it has to wait 100 microseconds for the five of the packets to go, and then what, doesn't it have to wait another 20 for this one to get sent?
Sorry, the 20 is that this is the, I mislabeled this here. So the 20, this 20 is the transmission delay for each of the packets. So we aren't counting for their propagation delay, but that's okay because we can start sending before the propagation delay finishes, is our hope. Other questions? Yeah.
So you mentioned that you're sending before the propagation delay finishes. Is that always a possibility so that you can just kind of negate the propagation delay? Or?
Is that the question? Can we always send before the propagation delay finishes? If we can't, that's going to affect our transmission speed, right? The assumption we have to wait, if we have to wait to send the next message, we probably have to wait to send the next bit for the same reason. Does that answer your question? Yeah, I think might be more complicated in a so-called multi-access network, right? We talked about like shared medium. Things might be more complicated with a shared medium. We are kind of glossing over those issues until much later in the semester. We'll talk about them more explicitly. But without a shared medium, hopefully, you know, if we can send one bit after the other, you know, we can in fact just, you know, send some stuff and have it be received later. Okay, so talk about latency. We also have round trip time is kind of back and forth. And this is what we'll typically actually measure because it's so much easier to measure than one-way latency. Like I kind of computed one-way latency. Actually measuring that is really hard. Right, how do you actually measure the physical latency on, you know, you can typically measure the round trip time. But actually, like dividing it up into the latency going forward and going backwards is difficult. Another thing that we might be concerned with is that latency isn't constant. That we're going to have some variation in latency. That if like we send packets that are evenly spaced, they're not going to come out evenly spaced. And the most common reason for this is we'll have some switches with queues, and sometimes we'll have to wait behind five packets. Sometimes we'll have to wait behind two. And that's going to, you know, even though there's no reordering, that's still going to cause us to have our latency vary a bunch because, as I showed you, you know, often that queuing delay will be a pretty huge component of our overall latency and round trip time. And let's talk kind of briefly about measuring these things. So you might be familiar with the ping utility, which is often, you know, one of the things it can do is measure the round trip time. And how is it working? Well, it's sending, you know, packets in one direction that are called a ping request, an echo request. So it sends a packet that's echoed back in the other direction and just sends a sequence of this and measures the time between when it sent and when it finished. So that's the round trip time. That includes all our latency forward plus the processing time to actually generate the packet to go back, and our latency backwards. And in this case, we are using the ICMP, which is the protocol for sort of error messages and diagnostics for the internet protocol. And it seems kind of customized to that. But that's what we're doing here. It turns out we can do this same round trip time measurement with something that isn't this specialized protocol. So for example, we can do it with, you know, TCP packets. So there's a tool called HPing, which I can get kind of the same kind of measurements. And what it's doing is instead of sending ICMP packets, this is actually TCP packets it's sending, and it's receiving a response, and this response, we won't talk about, this response is indicating error, no connection, and it's just measuring the time to get back, hey, there's no TCP connection this packet belongs to, what are you doing? And just measuring the time to get that error back. So we don't need a special protocol to do it. If we just have something which gives us a response, we can measure the round trip time with that. Yeah?
So for this example with HPing and the previous example with ping, why are they getting sent to different destinations?
Why are they getting sent to different destinations? This I could do on my laptop. HPing I wasn't willing to do on a, I couldn't use, 1.1.1 doesn't respond to TCP packets.
Okay.
But our web server does from within the internal network. So I just chose different machines for that reason.
Why would we use HPing?
Why would we use HPing? So if you're worried that different types of packets are handled differently, and you want to measure the round trip time for TCP, you might care that you're measuring, making sure that like the switches and routers and the end host doesn't handle TCP differently than ICMP. Also, this is going to get us to something we'll come up with when we're implementing kind of setting timeouts, is that we don't need a special thing to measure round trip time. We can do it with the packets we're already sending. And that's what we're going to end up doing to set timeouts for reliable transmission.
Thank you.